Welcome into the Boston Sports Summit presented by the network. I am your host, Tim Barnes. And before we started, I just want to ask you guys, like, share, subscribe, let everybody know about this because, you know, it's a great show. It's a fun one. I'm having a time because I get to talk about my favorite. So please, if you check out the Boston Summit here on Instagram at Boston Sports Summit. We got the Boston Sports Summit here on X. He's talking about that. Oh, we got a little bit of audio trouble here. Let's just change it up a quick second. Okay, we're back. So, no more of that. I keep trying something, doesn't work. So, here we go. We're just going to keep the old-fashioned wired headphones. All right, so welcome into the Boston Sports Summit. I am your presented by the Grid Network. I am your host, Tim Barnett. And please, like, share, subscribe, follow the show. We got all the content you want, all the content you need here on Instagram at Boston Sports Summit. X Boss Sports Summit. You got YouTube channel Boston Sports Summit, and we are always live every single Wednesday, 7 p.m. on the Grid Network's YouTube channel down on the left. So always check out the Grid Network because they have a litany of phenomenal shows, including Carving It Up, the 8 o'clock spot, where I sometimes, not regularly, but I would like to get more regular with the 8 o'clock spot. And I won the first time last week, so let's go. But 2 weeks ago, actually. But I do want to talk a lot about what we can expect from our teams. It has been a March Madness of Boston sports. And no, I'm not talking about UConn playing at the Garden for the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, because let's face it, UConn's not a Boston sports topic. And please, I don't want to get into the whole Connecticut, not New England, that fiasco, because it's boring. It's boring. But the March Madness that Boston is facing is the Celtics and Bruins are heading into the final stretch of the season. They have the playoffs just beyond the horizon. And while the Bruins are looking like they're trying to finish the stretch out strong, the Celtics, meanwhile, they're just kind of casual about it. With their blown 30-point loss to the Hawks, then they followed it up 2 or 3 days later with a back-and-forth game that they blew it, both of which were in Atlanta. So the playoffs are in sight for both teams. The Celtics rebounded off of that, but I am worried for the Celtics. I'm worried for the Celtics due to their inconsistencies as of late. And as for the Bruins, meanwhile, there's so much to be said about going in their goalie tandem that they want to have. Like, they want to go Allmark, Swayman, Allmark, and there's a lot of confusion going on with that. And with the playoffs just beyond the horizon, I'm going to talk about the goalies as well as the playoff scenarios of which they could face certain teams and why I like certain teams and why I would hate to see certain teams in round one. Meanwhile, the Patriots are in draft mode, draft season. And what I believe, well, what I hope to believe they would do versus some of the mock drafts that came out on The Athletic, and I'll talk a lot about that as well as catching up on some of the new rule changes. But first, we got to talk about the Boston Red Sox. I have been bashing this team left and right, and it hasn't been pretty. And before I get into their play, you know, and how they've done to start the season, I do want to bring up the fact that former team president Larry Lucchino passed away just the other day, if not yesterday, I think. And he was arguably the architect as to what the Red Sox have become in expecting championships. You know, the four championships, three of them were under his regime, and then the fourth one wasn't, but it was that mentality of having a winner. So Larry Lucchino, team president from 2002 to 2015, John Henry once called him the best CEO in sports. And Larry Lucchino had the infamous phrase of dubbing the Yankees the evil empire, which in my opinion still and will always hold true, because the Yankees are the evil empire, especially the fact that they have that whole facial hair policy. They got to keep the hair high and tight, which the hair high and tight, I got no problem with that, because I've never grown my hair out and I will never grow my hair out. But the whole facial hair thing, Johnny Damon having to cut his beard, crazy. But the interesting part about Lucchino was he was an Ivy League guy before the Ivy Leagues were churning out the clones that you see today. All the nerds that I keep, you know, ranting against and talking about how they keep ruining sports, that's what the Ivy Leagues keep churning out. And Craig Breslow is kind of that. But Lucchino going to Princeton wasn't that type of guy. You know, he was just a winner's mentality. He was an animal. That's all he wanted to do was win. And I don't blame him, you know, because at the end of the day, it's not about having the number one farm system. If the number one farm system isn't producing players that will win World Series, right? Like that's what you want. And that's what Lucchino wanted. He could have cared less about the farm system if it meant the major league team, the Red Sox, were competing and winning championships. Again, John Henry and that ownership group came in to break the curse of the Bambino, and they did, which was phenomenal under Lucchino, because he knew that superstars drove ratings, drove numbers. And one of the other big accomplishments that Lucchino did was he saved Fenway Park. And I can't imagine what going to Red Sox games would look like if Fenway Park was not still here. Like, that would be absolutely mind-blowing to me that Fenway Park would be demolished, right? Because that was kind of talked about. And I was pretty young at the time. It was right around the turn of the century, 99, 2000, 2001. And that there was a lot of talk about that. So the fact that they were able to save Fenway and still kind of adjust it, modernize it to what we know today, except I will say two things. They need to get the Coke bottles back on top of the Green Monster for those lights. And I was going to say that, you know, the Green Monster seat, actually, I am going to say the Green Monster seats are awesome. They are cool to have, but get those Coke bottles back on the light stands at Fenway, you know, above the Green Monster. But that's what's so wild to me, is that Lucchino is one of the guys instrumental in saving Fenway Park. I can't imagine how different Red Sox games would look like if Fenway Park still or wasn't around. And Lucchino helped start the Red Sox Foundation. He served as a chairman to the Jimmy Fund. And for those of you who don't know, he actually helped build Camden Yards when he was working for the Orioles, as well as revitalizing the downtown area around Petco Park in San Diego to help make that a attraction to go to. So that's pretty cool. But again, with his, you know, mentality of being a winner, being brash, being bold, not caring, he had some bad mistakes. Like, let's not deny that the man was a perfect man, because let's face it, who is? Yet he advocated. So he basically had the ugly divorce with Terry Francona, which ushered, and he advocated for Bobby Valentine to come in. And for those of you who don't remember, in 2012, you know, that awful year that Bobby Valentine was just a absolute mess that the Red Sox couldn't pull themselves out of. So They also had an ugly divorce with Theo because Lucchino kind of went back and forth with Theo for a long time. Theo was definitely one of the numbers guys, the nerds, the early analytics before it was what it was today. And a lot of the players that came in that system from 2007 to around like 2013, 2014 were a lot of his guys, a lot of Theo's guys. So it was kind of interesting in that regard that, you know, here's Larry Lucchino pushing out Terry Francona and Theo Epstein. Why? But also he lowballed John Lester, one of my favorite homegrown guys. He wanted to be a Red Sox. And the fact that the Red Sox just have now a history of this. It was kind of one thing with Lester when it happened, because he was really the first guy, the first homegrown guy that the Red Sox came in undervalued. They were like, no, you're worth this. We're not going to go up, even though they should have gone up. Because, again, it wasn't going to take, you know, $200 million to sign John Lester in 2014. And they traded him, got Yoenis Cespedes, which could have worked, but they were just like, nah, we're gonna rent him and then let him walk. But so, you know, Larry, the one thing I will say about Larry is the straight up fact that we don't get the winner's mentality with this team. And I don't think we break the curse of the Bambino if it wasn't for Larry Lucchino. Larry Lucchino is higher up on one of the, you know, on the Boston sports figures, higher than John Henry. Let's face it, John Henry just signed checks. And he had that infamous interview where he barged into 98.5 in 2011 and said, Larry Lucchino runs the Red Sox. So, yes, Larry Lucchino deserves a lot of praise and a lot of acumen for making the Red Sox contenders and winners and champions. So that's why I wanted to take some time to talk about Larry today, because, you know, he did pass away and he was definitely an important figure for the Red Sox turnaround and their, you know, winning championship. So rest in peace, Larry. And now to the actual games, right? First, I want to say that the Red Sox surprised me. The Red Sox absolutely surprised me with how they've performed over the last, since Thursday, right? So 6 days. They went 2-2 over the weekend. They swept Oakland. And I have it in my notes right here that said they went 2-2 over the weekend and versus the Mariners, and 2-1 with several asterisks versus the A's. Because I thought for sure they should win the series, but I didn't think they were going to lose the series. And I'll talk more about the A's in just a minute. But to get to Seattle, all right, so they had opening day on Thursday. And over those four games, the pitching staff was on fire, absolute fire. Because through five games, including the first game with Oakland, through the five games, all five pitchers started. And all five of them went at least five innings, which made them the fourth team in Major League Baseball history to open the season with five starts and at least five innings pitched with one walk or less and no more than two runs. Like, the starters were just unbelievable. You know, they, of course, there were a couple things here and there, but overall, that starting five was on fire. And Andrew Bailey had a hell of a philosophy of emphasizing more breaking off-speed pitches, right, and leading to a little reliance on the fastballs. And, you know, he goes on to say, or to talk about how, you know, the breaking balls have been more are off speed. There's more spin in the ball, because of course spin rate is such a huge thing to the nerds nowadays. That matters. And fastballs just get pummeled, get hit left and right. And the funny part was, I was thinking about it, and yeah, fastballs have been like the mainstay of baseball forever. Like, I don't even know if Cy Young knew what a curveball was. I wouldn't be surprised if Cy Young's two pitches were fastballs and changeups. Like, hello? Like, it wasn't – I couldn't tell you when the invention of the curveball came. I'm just making a hyperbole here. But still, you know, to say that fastballs, you know, have historically been, you know, crushed all the time. Oh, yeah, no doubt, dude. Like, fastballs are just as old as the sport of baseball. So, I don't know. I found that a little interesting. But entering Tuesday's game, so right before Bayo took his second start of the season, the starters had a 1.29 earned run average, going 28 innings pitch, 4 earned runs, 1 walk, and 37 strikeouts. Wild. While the relievers had a 1.65 ERA, going 16 and a third innings pitched, 3 earned runs, 5 walks, and 21 strikeouts. And they posted an MLB best 1.42 ERA. Wild. Absolutely wild to start the season off. And here I am, and I'll admit it, having to eat a lot of crow because I was bashing this team, going left and right, saying they did nothing in the offseason. The one pitcher that they signed got hurt. He's done for the year. And they still didn't make the move to get Jordan Montgomery, Blake Snell on deals that they should have signed them for, because John Henry doesn't want to sign long-term deals. And yet Jordan Montgomery and Blake Snell both signed practically one-year deals worth, you know, what, 60-something million overall? So that's why I, like, listen, I'll sit here and I love it, because as I told you, I want a baseball season. I love this sport. I love the Red Sox. I just, you know, it's hard for me to sit here and root for my team where the owners aren't showing love. If the owners aren't showing love, why should I show love? But yet here I stand. So I also want to say that the defense looked pretty good. You know, Trevor Story at shortstop. I wish they kept Bogaerts, but, you know, hey, Trevor Story at shortstop looked pretty good. Sedan Rafaela out in center field. I'll talk more about his catch in Oakland in a couple minutes, but he looks like a legit center fielder. He's got the speed. He's got the wherewithal to know his surroundings, and I like it. I like this kid. I wouldn't be shocked if Rafaela at the end of the year is in the running for Rookie of the Year after, what, 7 games in, you know, of 162. As long as he stays healthy, he could be in the running for Rookie of the Year, that's for sure. But, of course, I'm giving Red Sox all the praise. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some issues to be had, okay? And what I noticed in the Seattle series, games 2 and 3, depth is going to be an issue. This is a 162-game season starting from March 28th going all the way to the end of September. It may be a couple games in October. And do you believe that every single player, the starting nine and all the starters and all the relievers are going to be, you know, good? Do you think they're going to be healthy all year, make all their starts, do that? Absolutely not. You'd be foolish to think that our starting five is going to last the entire season and our starting nine is going to be fine. Well, first I want to get into Rafi Devers, because Rafi Devers missed games 2 and 3 with a sore shoulder. And he's had all offseason and the spring training to get it right. And now he's out with shoulder soreness. And while, again, I'm not going to sit here and overreact, I do wonder, why is he already dealing with this? What is going on with Devers that he's already got a shoulder soreness issue? Shouldn't that have been addressed during spring training? You know, shouldn't he have figured out what was going on? If this is something that happened at the end of the season, why didn't he get it fixed during the offseason? He had, you know, plenty of time. I mean, it's not like we made the playoffs last year or anything like that. But it is scary to me because with him out in game number two, the Red Sox were shut out 1-0 and couldn't get anything going on offense. Obviously, the score, you know, 0 says they couldn't get anything done on offense. But, you know, without Rafi Devers, there wasn't. They couldn't do anything. And then in game three, without him, they did hold a 3-1 lead in the 10th inning. But then you had guys, Wilbur Abreu, out on right field, make, I don't want to say an uncharacteristic error, just a really dumb, really bad error that you make in Double-A. Like, you don't make this error in Triple-A, because if you see it, there was a simple bloop shot right into right center field. Wilbur Abreu runs up to it, squares it up, and doesn't get his glove down all the way. And the ball goes right through his five hole. And Rafaela has to run over, pick it up, throw it in, allowing both runners, the runner on first to go to third, and the guy who hit it to go to second. It was stupid. And then, of course, the Mariners ended up tying it, which then allowed them to win the game, all in that inning, all in the bottom of the 10th. So you're sitting there going, like, what are we doing? Like, the defense has been good, but they still have guys who, honest to God, shouldn't be out here this early. You know, Wilbur Abreu is a guy you throw out in the dog days of summer in the middle of July because you have guys who are hurt. You know, you have that injury where they're on the 10-day DL. You're, you know, kind of in the thick of things, but you have to throw someone out there, and he's got enough experience where it's like, all right, you can get out there. We'll put up with, you know, whatever happens. Well, it's too early to be saying that. Game number three. Like, what are we doing here? And then speaking of game number three, one of the issues was you couldn't use your closer up 3-1 in Kenley Jansen because this fat ass slept wrong. Yeah, he slept wrong and has a tight back, which is why he was out for game number three. And to that I go, are you freaking kidding me? Like, this is the one thing about ball players that does kind of drive me nuts. You're sitting there. You have a 162-game season. You have a weight room, guys. I mean, is it that hard to stay somewhat in shape? You had over a month, maybe even a month and a half, to get ready, to get in baseball shape. And you have some of these guys who just come in overweight and are overweight the entire time. Like, guys, what are we doing? You're professional athletes. You're paid to train. You're paid to work out, basically, and play a child's game. So the fact that Kenley Jansen was out because he had a sore back from sleeping wrong, which no one knew in the media until Alex Cora told everybody after the game when he was asked, why didn't you throw Jansen out there, your closer? He's like, oh, well, he's out because he had a tight back. And then Jansen comes out and says, yeah, I slept wrong. Like, that's something you or I can use, but we still have to go to work regardless. You know, for him to say he's got a tight back because he slept wrong, that's what pisses me off. Like, stupid stuff like that. I mean, he's definitely older. He's what? He's late 30s, 38 years old, 39 years old. But it's like, come on, dude. Like, sleeping wrong? You have all the trainers in the world. You have better health staff than sports have ever had. And you slept wrong. Like, good God. And so that's why you lost game two and three. Nick Pivetta pitched his ass off in game two. I forgot to mention that, but he did. And now getting to Oakland, which wrapped up literally an hour ago. The Red Sox swept them. And, you know, I sit there and I laugh because here I am bitching about the Red Sox, talking about we're going to suck, we're going to finish in last, which, hey, we could still finish in last place, folks. I'm just going to throw that out there. It still could happen, but I'm bitching, blah, blah, blah. You know this. I've done it for literally almost 10 episodes. But now I will say Oakland blows. Absolutely blows. And it's wild to me. Like, here I am thinking, you're going to suck? At least you're putting out a Major League Baseball product. You know, what Oakland sent out is an absolute joke of a roster. Like, that is made for AAA right there. That team is made for AAA. And it's kind of a shame knowing that their history in, you know, or in and around the 80s and 90s were pretty good. And then, two, Moneyball, which I love Moneyball because they want to talk about, oh, we signed all these guys. Yeah, let's not forget, you had Barry Zito, Mark Mulder, and, Tim Hudson. You know, like three aces, you know, as you're starting pitching. And yet they're like, oh, we did it on the cheap. Yeah, spare me. But still, Oakland's got a good history. And then to see that, I mean, this is why I would love, if I was a commissioner of baseball, I would want to implement baseball, hell, all sports. I would want to implement what they do over in Europe with the soccer teams and have relegation, especially when it, you know, when you have the baseball, basketball, and hockey. You know, they each have their you know, minor affiliates, right? I would love to see the minor teams be brought up to the majors and stuff like that, because that would be fun. That would be cool. And then you have teams like Oakland, who the owner is such a cheap scumbag, clearly, that he's like, I'm just going to keep pocketing everything and spend $10 million on my team. Like, that team, I don't even know if they're worth $10 million as a whole, but it's just they're that bad, which is absolutely wild to me. Bring the relegation system in sports. I think that would be fun. Don't you think? Like, to have teams like, you know, Cleveland Browns back in the day in the NFL, when they were just garbage, hot garbage, like, they would have to fight for their lives in order to stay in the NFL. Like, wouldn't that be fun? Yeah, so that's kind of something I'm looking at when it comes to Oakland. But their one good player is that kid Mason Miller who pitched last night and was just throwing junk, but speed as well. Like, his slider was moving, and yet he could still reach 101. Watching some of his pitches, I'm going like, here's a guy that he would be unbelievable, a great setup guy for any team that's like competing for playoffs and in the for a World Series championship. He'd be an unbelievable setup guy with the stuff that he was throwing. I could have believed that the Red Sox snuck out that victory. But I also want to talk about the Rafaela catch last night, because that catch was, you know, maybe above average, and everybody, and literally, I mean, everybody was just going bananas for it. You know, talk about Red Sox fans who, again, just want everything to be so good, and they've been without, you know, a true center fielder since Jackie Bradley Jr., who can also hit too. But Rafaela making that catch, all of Red Sox Twitter and even Dave O'Brien and Kevin Youkilis, talk about having like a giant wad in your pants, just being like, oh my God, what a catch. He made a leaping grab. No, he didn't. He got a great read on the ball off the bat, running deep over his left shoulder. He ran fast, barely left the ground, and was still able to make the catch in stride. And listen, go watch the play for yourself. It was a good catch. It was. But this, you know, oh my God, leaping grab, this unbelievable catch, you know, Twitter blowing up like he had an unbelievable, like, no, come on. Like, can we, like, stop calling, you know, everything unbelievable? Hey, he made a good catch that saved a run last night and arguably helped win them the game. But it wasn't anything special, guys. It wasn't. And so if that's kind of like the stuff that I have a problem with. And, you know, just the overfixation of so great. I mean, in my opinion, the greatest catch I think I've ever seen in my lifetime had to be Jim Edmonds laying out with just going full this way and the ball coming directly over his head. Like, go watch that catch. That had to be the greatest catch I've ever seen in my life. Full extension, in midair, going, I can't even see the ball. Like, it's not going over either shoulder. It's directly in front of him. That is arguably the greatest catch I've ever seen. And so the fact that Red Sox fans lost their mind over that, hey, it's a good catch. You know, call it what it is. It's a good catch. Maybe above average, but that's what it was. And then today, Nick Pivetta dominating. Got out of a bases-loaded jam in the thick of the fifth. And, you know, through two games so far, the dude has pitched 11 innings, has a 0.82 ERA, 13 Ks, one walk, one run, and one earned. Like, dude is lighting it up. If anything, he should be the number one guy over Bayo, especially after what happened with Bayo in game two, giving up a couple of those home runs. He's been good. Bayo's been good, but this idea that him working with Pedro in the offseason and he's going to be, you know, the next Pedro Martinez, quite honestly, I haven't seen it yet. He's been good. I think there is upside for Brian Bayo. But overall, I just haven't seen it yet. And, you know, like, hey, until he can show it to me, then I'll believe. But I know there's a high ceiling for that kid. You know, and he signed a deal that if he hits that ceiling, it's going to be a hell of a deal for the Red Sox. But Nick Pivetta right now, he's clearly the ace of the Red Sox. And Nick Pivetta's career versus the Athletics, he's 6-0, has a 0.71 ERA, 38 innings pitched, 44 Ks, 10 walks, and an opposing batting average of 125. So, yeah. So, Nick Pivetta and the A's is phenomenal. Love the matchup. Love it. Like, that's, you need to be pitching Pivetta anytime you face the Athletics. But it also goes to show, the A's suck. So, it's been an interesting turn of events for the Red Sox. And listen, if this means we're going to get a summer, then I'm for it. As much as I hate ownership and wish the last place on the Red Sox, just because it proves that ownership needs to go out and actually spend money, I still want a season. Like, it's hard. It's a hard dynamic I have to flirt with. And if you have any questions about it, please hit me up. Don't, you know, feel free to write in and we can have this discussion more, because it's a tough one, at least for me. And don't forget, guys, please, I appreciate all of you for, you know, watching and following. And if you haven't already, you know, you can follow my stuff on Instagram at Boston Sports Summit and on X here at Boston Sports Summit, as well as my YouTube channel, and we're live every Wednesday here on the Grid Network. Now, next, we have the New England Patriots, and it is the middle of draft season. But before I get into the NFL draft and the Patriots at number three, what to expect, I do want to bring up, I meant to mention this last week, is the new rules for the hip drop tackle being banned, and the new kickoff rules. And so for the hip drop tackle, I just – I will say, I understand that, you know, everything is built on offense, right? And that's what the all the leagues, not just football, and not, you know, have done. They want to center everything towards offense, and high scoring is fun and entertaining for everybody. But you know why it's fun and entertaining for everybody? Is because there is the opportunity for defense to actually get stops. When there is that opportunity, then yes, scoring is fun. It's electric. But when you know that Chiefs have the ball, they march right down the field pretty much with ease. You know, Josh Allen and the Bills, before they obviously traded Stephon Diggs today, which was a very interesting but not so surprising move for Buffalo, that Josh Allen's got the ball, they're going to march right downfield and score. You know, Justin Herbert, march right downfield and score. Like, it's turning into the – my fear is that the NFL is turning into the NBA, because none of us watched that NBA All-Star game that nearly racked up 300 points because there was no defense. There was no effort except on the offensive side of things. And now, of course, it's an All-Star game. You're probably sitting there going, like, it's so different. But is it, though? Because how many times have NBA teams this season scored over 130 points in regulation? Like, that, to me, isn't fun. You know, to sit there and, you know, have the Celtics win by over 30 points on a consistent basis, is that fun? And now that the NFL has banned the hip drop tackle, how the hell else are these guys supposed to tackle? Now, obviously, you're going to be like, well, you know, you just get in front of them and stand them up and, you know, do all of that. True. They can't. But what about the times you're trying to tackle Tyreek Hill and he's just running like he normally does at 50 miles an hour and you make a bad angle, you still have an opportunity to tackle him, but you have to kind of adjust yourself and run from behind and you grab him and just your momentum is pulling you the other way. You're not trying to drop your hip. You're just being pulled the other, your momentum is taking you one way while you're trying to tackle this guy. So you're just kind of like, you're stuck. Basically what you're telling me is you can tackle him. You're going to have to let him run and gain all that yak and have him score that touchdown, which I don't agree with. And everybody wants to say, oh, well, you have all these injuries off the hip drop tackle. Okay, yeah, Mark Andrews got hurt. But I guarantee you, when you watch the film, there is plenty of hip drop tackles where guys get right up. They do. One of those famous plays in NFL history came in Super Bowl 34. Rams, Titans. That final tackle on the 1 yard line. What did that Rams linebacker do? He dropped his hip. Kevin Dyson is stuck extending his arm over the 1 yard line, trying to get that ball over the end zone. Didn't happen. That was a hip drop tackle. And yet now, with everything that's gone on, it's defense is basically, you know, can't tackle. You have to wrap them up, pick them up, pull out a pillow out your ass, lay it on the ground. Don't forget the blanket, though. Don't forget the blanket. You lay the running back, the quarterback, the wide receiver down with his head on the pillow, and then you drape the blanket over him. Don't forget to tuck him in. That's how you're supposed to tackle in the new NFL. Like, what are we trying to do here? Because it's ridiculous to me. It's a tough sport. It's a gladiator sport. The only way that your players can tackle now is getting taken out at the knees. That's it. Or you wrap them up traditionally. Explain that to me. Explain how this is going to benefit the NFL. Because I think it's just going to lead to what we see in the NBA with all these points scored, barely any defense. And I know people want to say that the 13-3 Super Bowl, you know, Rams, Patriots, you know, was boring. Okay, if you're a casual fan, then yes, I could see that being boring. But if you're a football fanatic and you love the game and want to study the game, then that's a great game to watch. And yet, to sit here and say that a 45 to 42 game is fun and entertaining. It can be, except that basically you're telling me that neither team can play defense and that the offense has all the room in the world to maneuver. So the hip drop tackle clearly pisses me off. But also, too, the new kickoff rules, and for those who've never seen the XFL, basically the kicker kicks from the 35 like they normally do, and the kickoff team is going to line up at the opposing team's 40-yard line, whereas the return team is going to line up between the 35 and the 40. And the kick return is going to line up somewhere between the goal line and I think the 20. Like, you can maneuver it however you want, but nine guys have to be on the line to block for the returner. So you can have one or two return men in the back to kind of change everything up. And if the ball goes in the end zone or out of the end zone, that's going to be a touchback at the 30. And if it's out of bounds, obviously the ball is going to start at the 40. So they're moving the ball up another 5 yards for a touchback. So they're going to force kickers to try to kick it in that boundary, that 20-yard boundary, for more return plays. And I think that's going to be fun. I think it's going to be entertaining. And the interesting part about it is no one can move until the returner caught the ball or the ball hits the ground. Whichever one comes first, that's when teams can move. So I think it's going to bring some excitement. I think that, again, this is all part and parcel due to one bad play leads to everything changing. And, you know, is it going to bring the kickoff back? Absolutely. And I love that, because the NFL should never get rid of the kickoff, because that's part of the game. But I do wish that we could go back to the old days, because watching Devin Hester, he was electric factory. And so I think it's going to bring the kickoff back, but I'm a traditionalist. I love the old-fashioned kickoff, and just a couple plays here and there have ruined the kickoff, I think, for everybody. And a side note to the kickoff, though, it will be interesting to see how about 99% of the guys who have played in the NFL, who are getting drafted the NFL this season, have never done this ever. So that's going to be really interesting to watch and see if the NFL tries to pluck guys from the XFL or UFL as it is now. But the UFL, I think, has got the old-fashioned kickoff from what I saw over the weekend. But now the NFL draft is coming up. It's upon us. And obviously, we all know what the Patriots need. They need a quarterback, they need wide receivers, and they need offensive line help, especially at left tackle. But there is so much, you know, talk going on at number three. You know, number three overall, it's scary to see how everything is going on. And before I get into that, Not Doug says, Pats need to address O-line first. Do you think that they should trade number three for a veteran O-line, then draft another one later in the first round? I mean, it's interesting to me, because there's so much that's going on with the NFL draft and what they should do at three. Now, everybody wants to say, look at Houston. You know, they drafted C.J. Stroud. Everybody was all on the Bryce Young train, but they drafted C.J. Stroud, and, you know, they're basically set up to be in the AFC Championship game next year, especially with the addition of Stephon Diggs. That being said, don't forget, they were building their team. They had a solid left tackle. They had Nico Collins. They drafted Tank Dell last season, and now has traded for Stephon Diggs and have a pretty decent defense. So to sit there and you do you need an offensive lineman? Absolutely. An offensive, I have the philosophy that you need to build from the inside out, right? Build a D-line, build an O-line, because what that's going to do is, especially, let's talk about the O-line first. If you build an offensive line that is elite, elite, i.e. Dallas Cowboys of the 90s, that O-line, phenomenal. And I think what it can do is it turns a average quarterback into at least an above average quarterback and gives, you know, the receivers more time, you know, to get open, gives the running back more lane to get through. And on the defensive side, if you build an elite defensive line, you're going to be able to stop that run while also getting to the quarterback, you know, so fast that they're not going to be able to, the receivers aren't going to be able to get open, which is going to make your average cornerbacks and linebackers and safeties look at least above average. So that's kind of the philosophy that I have. And I would love to see them trade back. You know, I would. But I also don't want to trade back to, you know, 18, 19, 20 either. If they can get a second pick that gives them 18, 19, 20, then great. But the only team that has that is Minnesota. The downfall of that is you going from 3 to 11. And I, as much as I would love that and have talked about San Francisco jumping up that far to Miami, like Miami was, you know, for the most part set, right? They were most part set, which is why they could afford to jump back. The problem is you need everything. And I've gone through several mock drafts myself, and you can check that out on my X at Boss Sports Summit. But it's interesting because to draft an O-lineman, I love this kid, Joe Alt. Unless we're trading with, you know, the Chargers or the Giants, I don't think we're going to get Alt. And there are a few mock draft scenarios that the Athletics, Nick Bumgarner and Chad Graff came out with, which I want to just talk about because I thought it was really interesting that none of these guys had the Patriots drafting at 3 overall. So their trade scenario number A was with the Vikings. The Patriots would get 11, 23, and a 25 third-round pick for New England's number 3. Now, I would argue that that's super cheap to know kind of what San Fran and how they jumped up to number 3 to get Trey Lance, what they gave up. Yeah, you need to get a similar return, if not a better return, due to the fact that New England is screwed when it comes to draft capital. Or not draft capital, but, you know, talent, especially on the offensive side. So with that, New England at 11 took all of Ulu Fashanu, the offensive tackle out of Penn State, which I like. They took Bo Nix at 23 and Ladd McConkey, the wide receiver out of Georgia, at 34. Now, I like two of those three picks. Give me Ulu Fashanu. Give me McConkey. Do not give me Bo Nix. As a Florida Gator, I went to school there, worked for the football team for a few years as a recruiting assistant. I saw Bo Nix. I saw Bo Nix play at Auburn, and boy, did that dude suck. Now, there was a lot of hype, obviously, with the fact that his father played it at Auburn, and now he's, you know, has to live up to all his hype. But yet, Bo Nix is a checkdown king. You know, he averaged, what, 6 yards per throw last season in Oregon, and a lot of their receivers made up the difference because they're just that good. The kid could throw it deep. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying he doesn't have any arm strength, but the system in Oregon worked. I don't know if that system in Oregon can translate into the NFL. I think if Bo Nix has a chance of succeeding in this league, the only team he should go to is not only a team with a offensive-minded head coach, But in my opinion, I think Jim Harbaugh, because the dude made Alex Smith, you know, into a, you know, good, if not pretty good quarterback, you know, and Alex Smith was not good. So carving it up with Bryson Carter, saying totally with you on Bo Nix. He is the closest to a finished product as any of the QBs, so not a ton of room for growth. Yeah, I think he's close to, if not hit, his ceiling. And his ceiling is not good, in my opinion. I think what you saw in Oregon was a system built for Bo Nix. You know, whereas what he did in Auburn, now again, it's the SEC, it's Auburn. There's a very different play style in the SEC. But overall, I don't think that's he clearly couldn't succeed, couldn't live up to the hype, and that's what scares me. Now, Bryson Carver carving it up with Bryson, you know, it's also, hey, don't forget to check out his show here on the Grid Network. Great show, talks everything, all sports, and he's got some great viewpoints. The only thing that him and I disagree on is the Florida, Tennessee. Don't like that, though. But he goes, if Michael Penix Jr. is available, take him. Kid is easily the second-best quarterback. And I'm with him on that. I do understand why Michael Penix isn't getting all the love in the world because of, you know, his injury history. He's got a shoulder injury. He's a lefty, so he's got a left shoulder injury. It's right over here. And he's got two ACL issues that, you know, knocked him out for several seasons. But the dude stays healthy. In my opinion, he is the purest passer, you know, coming into this draft. I would take him over Caleb Williams if he was 100% healthy, had no injury history. That's right. And I've talked about it that I don't like Caleb Williams because I think the dude's got all – he's totally messed up in the head, and he's going to absolutely melt down. So getting to scenario number B, that Chad Graff and Nick Bumgarner – proposed, they had Minnesota trading 11, 23, a 25 third rounder to New England for three, and New England trading 11 and 68 in a future pick to Arizona for number four. So at number four, the Patriots are taking J.J. McCarthy at 23. They take Amarius Mims out of Georgia, and at number 34, they stick with Ladd McConkey once again. I'm okay with that, except for the fact that J.J. McCarthy somehow went from being a second-tier quarterback to top five, if not top three. I don't get it. I don't know where this love came from. Now, granted, he had a very good pro day. He's got very good feet. I want to watch some more film on him to kind of get that understanding. And I will be making my quarterback tiers next week. So stay tuned next week. Wednesday at 7, Boston Sports Summit for my quarterback tiers of this draft. But J.J. McCarthy, like, he was serviceable in Michigan. Their whole system was ground and pound, be tough, and you know, don't turn the ball over. And that's what he did. But I don't understand how all of this, and again, it is Lions season here in the NFL because it is draft season. So I don't mind the Amarius Mims at tackle, and obviously love Ladd McConkey. The dude had an unbelievable combine as well as going to the Senior Bowl. But trade scenario number C, the Patriots are trading with the Raiders at the time, where Las Vegas trades 13, 44, 112, and a 2025 first rounder for number three. So at number 13, the Patriots take J.C. Latham out of Alabama, Adonai Mitchell at 34, and Michael Penix at number 44. And I love that. That I would do. I'm not so huge on the J.C. Latham because I think a lot of the offensive linemen that come out of Alabama are ceiling. There is none. Like, they are a finished product. That's it. And J.C. Latham was good, but I don't know if he's going to be, you know, the elite, you know, offensive tackle that you need, you know, especially left tackle. So he scares me. Adonai Mitchell, Adonai Mitchell, the wide receiver out of Texas, who ran the fastest 40 in history at the combine. Obviously, I love speed. It would be great. And then if he, you know, became a kickoff returner and was able to, he could be the next Devin Hester. That's saying a lot, but it would be fun to watch for sure. And then Michael Penix, he's my guy. I love Michael Penix. And then the last trade scenario I want to get to is the Patriots traded with the Broncos. Broncos trading number 12, 76, a 25 second, and Pat Surtain the second to New England for number 3, in which case the Patriots at number 12 take Talese Fuaga, the offensive tackle at Oregon State, and Keon Coleman, the wide receiver out of Florida State. And so I think that's interesting to get Pat Surtain, stir up the DB room with Christian Gonzalez on one side, Pat Surtain on the other, would be electric. We'd arguably have a top 10 defense with that right there. But our offense would still struggle. You know, and again, all those trade scenarios that I listed are on The Athletic by Nick Bumgarner, Chad Graff. They do a whole 7 round for each trade scenario, but I just wanted to highlight the first couple picks because that is where I think the Patriots are going to win or lose this draft. And with all the talk about them, you know, staying at 3, Gerard Mayo's coming out there saying that we're open to trading 3. I think at the end of the day, they're going to want to stay at 3. And if they take J.J. McCarthy, it's going to be a friggin' snooze fest. To me, it's going to be like taking N'Keal Harry all over again, where when the Patriots took N'Keal Harry, they had A.J. Brown, D.K. Metcalf, Deebo Samuel, all on the board available to them, and they took N'Keal friggin' Harry. Like, that's good how I'm going to feel. If they took Drake May, all right. You know, there is a high ceiling for the kid. He's younger. You know, he doesn't have as much experience. But, you know, at the end of the day, Gerard Mayo's going out there without being provoked, saying how Drake May also has a floor, too, that we have to take into account. I don't know why you'd have to take into account the floor. If the dude sucks, the dude sucks, you know? But that's why, again, this should have been a year where they signed a Gardner Minshew or somebody, you know, to that effect. I wanted Kirk Cousins. I would have paid the friggin' money to sign Kirk Cousins because, trust me, the Robert Kraft and the Patriots, they totally believe in the cap, in the salary cap and all that. And you could do so much in the NFL with a salary cap that they would have been fine. Trust me. But I don't know. It's going to be interesting. And so I just look at it going, what are the Patriots going to do? And I would be interested to see, you know, going back to not Doug's question, you know, should they trade 3 for a veteran O-lineman and draft one later? I wouldn't be opposed to that. My first mock draft that I did several weeks ago, I went super heavy on offensive linemen and wide receiver. I did get Michael Penix later on in the round, but I traded back, got a few extra O-linemen, and it was something that I have a philosophy of building in the trenches, which can make your outside guys better than, hey, they actually might be. Not to say they can't grow, but at least for the time being. And right now, the only trench that we have is basically the D-line. And they are good, not great. You know, I would argue, okay, above average, good to above average, but not great. Our O-linemen, garbage, crap. And that's kind of what scares me heading into this season. Now, transitioning over to some playoff talk, which both the Red Sox and Patriots, at least as it stands right now, we're not talking playoffs. But talking playoffs, first team we're going to talk about is the Celtics. All right, the Celtics, before I get into them, I do want to just bring up the fact that Rajon Rondo retired, spent his first 9 seasons in Boston, And in the 92 playoff games with the Celtics, he had 10 triple-doubles and averaged 14.5 points, 9.2 assists, and 6 rebounds per game. The dude was great. I did enjoy Rondo for a long time. He was a heck of a player. Fun to watch with the ball in his hands, the way he was able to distribute. He had that those super long fingers that he was kind of a freak in that regard. But as much as I remember him for the 08 championship, 2012, game two against Miami, where we ended up losing that series, game two, I will never forget this. In the closing seconds of, I want to say it was the fourth quarter or overtime. Actually, it might have been overtime. Rajon Rondo was having the game of his life. It was kind of, you know, almost his coming out party in a sense, because he was never this type of scorer. The dude was hitting threes. He was scoring. I think he got like 41, 42 points that game. But he was going up for a breakaway layup where you have D. Wade coming from behind, legitimately clotheslined him in midair, never called it, even though the ref was standing 2 feet away, never called it. Miami turns it around, goes on a fast break, gets the points. It was literally a back-and-forth game. Celtics took the lead, Miami ties it up. Celtics took the lead, Miami ties it up. Then that play happens, and Miami wins it going away. Boston won the next three games, and then game six in Boston. I think we all remember LeBron just going off the way he did. But that was the final game of the big three. And that is what I will never forget Rondo for. While all the great things that he did in Boston, in my mind, he will always be remembered for breaking up the big three and how him and Ray Allen had this beef that was stupid. The fact that Rondo wouldn't throw him the ball, allegedly, and that Ray and him had this, you know, heat between one another, for Ray to take less money to go to Miami, I think said everything. And then when the whole Rondo thing came out, I couldn't believe how much Garnett and Pierce really hated Ray for a time. And especially Garnett. Because if they knew that Rondo and Ray hated each other and didn't like each other, you know, I understand it hurt for Ray to leave and not let them know the way that he left. But that's what really bothered me. That's what really bothered me, because the big three was great. Now, could they have, you know, competed next year, you know, with Ray Allen on the team? I don't know, because having Rondo break up the big three, I think left Danny Ainge in a position where he was able to trade Garnett, Pierce, and Jason Terry to Brooklyn to get the haul that we did, which landed us Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. So all in all, as much as it sucked during the time and ridiculous that Rondo arguably, allegedly, was the guy that broke up the big three, it landed us, you know, where we sit today. And where we sit today is a team that is number one in the NBA, yet doesn't know how to close out games, you know, like when it's a tight game. You know, when they're ahead by two, tied or down by two in the closing minutes, they crap their pants every single time, because they go to this ISO ball, and that's not their style. That's not their team game. You know, losing to Atlanta twice last week pissed me off. And as much as I understand people in Boston sports media wanting to kind of say, well, hey, you know, it's the team is, you know, just looking ahead. They're looking for, you know, the playoffs to be here. We want the playoffs here. Yeah, I do too. I'm kind of sick of the regular season myself. But you don't lose to Atlanta twice, especially when they don't have their best player on the court. You had a 30-point lead and you blew it. You had Jaylen Brown dribble the ball 23 times in a possession only to have him do a fadeaway three from the wing, which had no shot of making it. On top of the fact, too, The following game, a couple days later in Atlanta, it was a tighter game going back and forth. DeJounte Murray had a game for his life. And yet, Tatum has the ball. The shot clock, I think, was plus five, you know, plus four, plus five. So, in other words, when the shot clock hit zero, the regulation clock was still at 4 or 5 seconds remaining. But somehow got, you know, a sneaky call. I wouldn't say Tatum embellished or anything like that, but I think the call might have been a little soft, which somehow negated the shot clock, and the Celtics retained possession and had no shot clock for 6.2 seconds, all the while Tatum getting the ball, making a move which sent him to his left, and doing the sideways fall-away three, which, again, also had no chance of making it. And it kind of, you know, just this idea that they need to play iso ball. Right now, both the Jays are not good enough to play iso ball in the waning minutes. And even though Jason Tatum wants to tell himself that I need to be the guy to hit these final shots, which I would argue, yes, he does, he can't do it right now. And I know that, oh, I'm due. He's due. That's true. But when you take shots like that, you'll never make it. You will never get that opportunity. If you want to drive to the hole, if you want to go and take a shot at the free throw line, the top of the key, the elbow, you know, something that's more high percentage, you know, move off a screen, something like every single time, every single loss, you know, in those two games, no one else was moving. It was pure iso ball. And this team is not good enough to handle pure iso ball to close out a game, to win the game, to go ahead, to tie it, whatever. And that's what scares me for this team going into the playoffs. You know, because they're not going to win by 30 points every night. They're not going to win going away every night. They might win a couple going away, you know, but this team knows how to relax, knows how to take nights off. And I, you know, don't know why Joe Mazzulla doesn't change them. You know, doesn't say, here's a play that I'm going to draw up. You're going to throw it at Porzingis. Porzingis is going to get it to Holiday. He's going to get it to White, who then is going to get it to Tatum, all in the span of 5 seconds. Tatum's going to hit the buzzer beater, you know, 10 feet off the glass. It's good. You know, something like that. You know, get the ball moving. That's how these guys should and need to win. So I don't want to say that those two games in Atlanta, you know, are going to tell us what they're going to do in the playoffs. But if they lose games like that, and it's not the first time either. Jason Tatum this season is 0 for 6 when it comes to the final shot in the final for the go-ahead shot in the final minute, final seconds. He's 0 for 6. And we all remember that time, that game against Denver in Boston, where he was so hurried that he didn't understand that 3 seconds was a hell of a lot longer than 1.5. You know, because that's how much time he gave himself when he caught the ball, did his turnaround, and fadeaway. There was still plenty of time on that clock because everything was so sped up in his mind. And so that's what I'm worried about when games get tighter, when they can't beat these teams going away by 20, 30 points. And do they give up? Will they give up? At the end of the day, I believe this is a championship or bust season. But with them playing Oklahoma City tonight to secure themselves the number one overall seed in the NBA, you know, how are they going to play? SGA is out for OKC. So this should be an automatic win for the Celtics. But again, You know, are they going to give up tonight, or are they actually going to hold themselves accountable? Because they did. They held themselves accountable against Charlotte the other night. So it's not like they lost those two games to Atlanta and then stunk it up after that. No, they did rebound against the Pelicans and Charlotte, you know, beating them both. But again, it's New Orleans and that's Charlotte. You're not going to see New Orleans because they're not going to the NBA Finals. And you're definitely not going to see Charlotte because they stuck. That's it. That is an organization that's a perennial loser and will always be a perennial loser. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Celtics do when it comes to the playoffs this year. And with six games remaining, the Boston Bruins also are staring down the barrel that is the playoffs. And after their playoff disappointment that was last season, what are they going to do? My big question is, who's going to be their goaltender for game one? Because they kept continuously talking about all season long, we're going to platoon, we're going to platoon. It's going to be Swayman or Allmark, and then the next game is going to be the other guy, whoever it is. Well, so far, I went back to that to the website that I got my stats from, which is quanthockey.com, which gave me all the goalie stats that I need, and I could even put in certain dates and how they did. And I used that right after the trade deadline to show that Allmark, right after the trade deadline, was performing better than Swayman. Now, I went back to it because I still wanted to see if Swayman was able to make up any ground. Because even though Allmark, since the trade deadline, which was March 8th, I put everything in from March 9th to today, April 3rd, Allmark is 4-2. Swayman is 3-2. Allmark is third in the NHL with a 1.51 goals against average, whereas Swayman is 38th in the NHL with a 3.37 goals against average. And I should make a note that since all these stats are all the goaltenders that have played a minimum of five games or more since March 9th. All right. And so Allmark is third in the NHL once again with a .950 save percentage, where Swayman is 45th in the NHL with an .858 save percentage. So if the playoffs started today, I don't understand why you would platoon. If anything, you need to keep Allmark as your guy and ride him. Now, granted, I don't trust either of these guys, but I was on the boat of saying, give me Swayman. Give me Swayman. That's the guy that we need because we need to see what we have in him in order to prepare us for the future. But you didn't. You kept Allmark. You couldn't get rid of him. You couldn't find the right deal for him. You couldn't figure out a place where he wanted to go and the return you could have got for him. But now Allmark is doing better than him. You know, Allmark is the guy. If they platoon, they're going to be foolish for doing that. But if they play Allmark, they're going against everything they've talked about all season. So these teams, I have to admit, have to stop, you know, predicting the future and stop lying to us. You know, because either way, the Bruins don't look good in this scenario. Now, going into the playoffs, it's going to be interesting to see because the NHL standings, as it currently stands, Boston is number one in the Atlantic with 103 points. Florida is right behind, just 4 points behind them. Both teams have clinched playoff spots. Florida's got 99, and then Toronto hasn't clinched, but they are at 95 points, which is 4 points behind the Panthers. Meanwhile, in the Metro Division, you have the Rangers and Hurricanes, both have clinched playoff spots. The Rangers are number one with 104 points. The Hurricanes are two with 101 points. The Rangers, meanwhile, are number one in the President Trophy race. And the Flyers are at third with 83 points. Meanwhile, on the wild card, you have the Lightning, who are holding steady at number one in the wild card with 89 points. The Capitals are tied but hold the number two wild card spot with 82 points. The Red Wings are the team that the Capitals are tied with 82, but they are just out based on the tiebreakers. And then you have the Islanders with 81 and the Penguins with 79. So as it currently stands, if the playoffs started tonight, then the Bruins would be playing the Lightning. And that scares the crap out of me. That absolutely scares the crap out of me. And because the way Tampa has played Boston this season has been a little surprising to me. Now, before I continue on, not Doug saying it's all about who's hot. You know, that's right. You know, which is the hotter goaltender? And clearly it is Ullmark. And that's why, you know, I don't want this platoon. Even though the Bruins have been telling us they're going to platoon, clearly it's Ullmark. And if they platoon, they're going to be foolish. But if they, you know, stick with Ullmark, then they basically lied to us saying that, you know, hey, we've been platooning. We're going to platoon. Well, no, you're not, you know, because you're going to ride the guy that's hot. But with Tampa, that scares me because even though, yeah, all right, 89, 104, like points, points are just getting you to the playoffs. But when you play, anything goes. I've talked about this once and I'll say it again. Playoff hockey is the most, is the craziest playoffs you will ever see. It is the best playoff you will ever see. That's the playoffs where even if the Bruins don't even make the playoffs, I will sit and watch playoff hockey because of how fun and entertaining it is. Because if you've never heard of puck luck, you're going to be hearing it a lot, especially on this show, come playoff time. Because puck luck is a real thing. It is a real thing where it doesn't matter if you're the best team. Just a half an inch can be the difference between a goal and hitting the post. That's all it takes. All it takes. Crazy bounces left and right can be the difference. And that's what scares me about the Bruins and playing the Lightning, because the Lightning have played well. I've been paying attention to the Lightning this season, and I thought they sucked for a long time, most of this season, but they've snuck in. They've turned it on. And talk about being a hot team. They have been turning it on recently. And especially, like I said, the way they've been playing the Bruins, Vasilevskiy to me is the greatest goaltender in the world. And if he's on, he's on. And that's why, to me, I don't want to play the Lightning. But a team I do want to play, and I don't think we will based on the way this season is looking like it's going to end, is Toronto. Because let's face it, the Maple Leafs are going to do Maple Leaf things. They are softer than you. And that's why I want to play them, because somehow, some way, the Maple Leafs are fake tough guys, and the Bruins aren't, you know, much better. They are weak. You know, they are softer team. They're a more skilled team. But the Maple Leafs, man, they have all the talent in the world, but somehow the Bruins own that ass. They do. And that's why I want to play Toronto more than anybody, but I don't think that's going to happen. Meanwhile, the Bruins probably have to win the President's Trophy in order to play the last wild card team, which right now would be the Capitals. And I'm 50-50 on them because even though, you know, we're 1-1 against them this season, they shut us out after we dominated against the Canucks right after the trade deadline. Right after the All-Star break, excuse me. And then we just beat them on Saturday, I think it was, in a 3-2 shootout, which, to Boston's credit, killing a four-minute, four-on-three in overtime had to have been a moment that if the Bruins can make a run, you know, a deep run at that, make it to the Stanley Cup Finals, that's going to be a moment that they're gonna highlight to and be like, right there, killing a four-minute, four-on-three in overtime against Washington and then winning in the shootout. That's where we knew we are going to be good enough to make a run. And then, of course, the Bruins also play the Capitals one more time, which will be the second to last game of the season. So that would be actually – that would be kind of an interesting playoff preview if we play them in the second to last game and then everything works out the way it does and we end up playing the Capitals. That would be actually pretty funny to me. But the last team would be the Red Wings. And we're 2-2 against the Red Wings this season. So, you know, again, Detroit, again, kind of the same way, 50-50. What scares me, too, with any playing any of those teams, the second wild card, is that they're going to be fighting for their lives just to get in. They're going to be playing every game like it's their last, like they got nothing to lose, which is exactly what the Panthers did last year, and we all know how that went. And that's what scares me about playing a team like that, whereas if you play the third-place team or the second-place team, you know, in the division, then you're both kind of sitting there relaxed, you're fine, and then everything ramps up. So it's going to be interesting to me to see how everything plays out. But the Bruins right now, they got to figure it out. They got to figure out the goaltender. The numbers are the numbers. Omark's hot right now. But, you know, Swayman's got to get his act together. He does. He's got to figure it out, because if he's still playing like that come playoff time, then I would be okay with either letting Swayman walk or paying him a very, very cheap contract for the next couple of years. So tell me what you think. I appreciate you guys sticking around. Appreciate you listening. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe. Please follow me if you can on all the social medias, on Instagram here, Boston Sports Summit, on X, Boss Sports Summit, you know, YouTube, Boston Sports Summit. And also, guys, if you haven't, check out the Grid Network, all their great shows. Okay, you know, we got like Bryson Carver with Carving It Up, chiming in. Appreciate you, Bryson. Not Doug, appreciate you for commenting tonight. And for all you guys watching, tuning in, thank you so much. God bless. And for the Boston Sports Summit, I am your host, Tim Barnett. We are on the Grid Network every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Thank you for watching, and God bless. Have a great rest of your night, and have a great weekend, everyone.